back on the ground. "Roland Croninger." "Roland," she repeated, making it sound like she was licking a lollipop. "You're not going to give me to them, are you, Roland?" "Was he your husband?" Roland prodded Rudy's body with his foot.
"No. We traveled together, that's all."
Actually, they had lived together for almost a year, and he'd done some pimping for her back in Oakland, but there was no need to confuse the kid. She looked at Rudy's bloody throat and then quickly away. She felt a pang of regret, because he'd been a good business manager, a fantastic lover, and he'd kept them supplied with plenty of blow. But he was just dead meat now, and that was how the world turned. As Rudy himself would have said, you cover your own ass at all and any cost. Something moved on the ground behind Sheila, and she turned to look. A vaguely human shape was crawling toward her. It stopped about 7 or 8 feet away, and a hand covered with open running sores lifted a paper bag.
"Candy bars?" a mangled voice offered.
Roland fired the automatic, and the noise of the shot made Sheila jump. The thing on the ground grunted and then made a sound like a yelping dog. It scrambled to its knees and scurried away amid the junked vehicles. Sheila knew the kid wasn't going to turn her over to them after all. Hoarse, garbled laughter came from other hidden pits in the dirt. Sheila had seen plenty of hell since she and Rudy had left a coke dealer's cabin in the Sierras where they'd been hiding from the San Francisco cops when the bombs had hit. But this was by far the worst. She looked down into the kid's goggled eyes because her height approached 6 feet. She was as big-boned as an Amazon warrior, but all curves and compliance when it met her needs, and she knew he was hooked through the cock.
"What the hell is this shit?"
Macklin said, leaning over the items he'd pulled out of Sheila's backpack. Sheila knew what the one-handed man had found. She approached him, disregarding the kid's .45, and saw what he was holding. A plastic bag full of snow-white, extra-fine Colombian sugar. Scattered around him were 3 more plastic bags of high-grade cocaine and about a dozen plastic bottles of poppers, black beauties, yellow jackets, bombers, red ladies, PCP, and LSD tabs.
"That's my medicine bag, friend," she told him. "If you're looking for food, I've got a couple of old Whoppers and some fries in there, too. You're welcome to it, but I want my stash back."
"Drugs," Macklin realized. "What is this, cocaine?"
He dropped the bag and picked up one of the bottles, lifting his filthy, blood-splattered face toward her. His crew cut was growing out, the dark brown hair peppered with gray. His eyes were deep holes carved in a rock-like face.
"Pills, too? What are you, an addict?"
"I'm a gourmet," she replied calmly.
She figured the kid wasn't going to let this crazy one-handed fucker hurt her. But her muscles were tensed, for fight or flight.
"What are you?"
"His name is Colonel James Macklin," Roland told her. "He's a war hero."
"Looks to me like the war's over, and we lost, hero," she said, staring directly into Macklin's eyes. "Take what you want, but I need my stash back."
Macklin sized the young woman up, and he decided he might not be able to throw her to the ground and rape her, as he had intended until this instant. She might be too much to take with one hand, unless he wrestled her down and got the knife to her throat. He didn't want to try and fail in front of Roland, though his penis had begun to pound. He grunted and dug for the hamburgers. When he found them, he flung the pack to Sheila, and she started gathering up the packets of coke and the pill bottles. Macklin crawled over and pulled the shoes off Rudy's feet. He worked a gold Rolex wristwatch from the corpse's left wrist and put it on his own.
"How come you're out here?"
Sheila asked Roland, who was watching her pack the cocaine and pills away.
"How come you're not over there, closer to the light?"
"They don't want dirt warts," Macklin replied. "That's what they call us, dirt warts."
He nodded toward the rectangular hole a few feet away.
It had been covered with a tarpaulin, impossible to detect in the darkness, and looked to Sheila to be about 5 feet deep. The corners of the tarp were held down with stones.
"They don't think we smell good enough to be any closer."
Macklin's grin held madness.
"How do you think I smell, lady?"
She thought he smelled like a hog in heat, but she shrugged and motioned toward a can of Right Guard deodorant that had fallen out of Rudy's pack. Macklin laughed. He was unbuckling Rudy's belt in preparation to pull the trousers off.
"See, we live out here on what we can get and what we can take. We wait for new ones to pass through on their way to the light."
He motioned with a nod of his head toward the lake shore.
"Those people have the power. Guns, plenty of canned food and bottled water, gas for their torches. Some of them even have tents. They roll around in that salt water and we listen to them scream. They won't let us near it, oh no. They think we'd pollute it or something."
He got Rudy's trousers off and flung them into the pit.
"See, the hell of all this is that the boy and I should be living in the light right now. We should be wearing clean clothes and taking warm showers and having all the food and water we want because we were prepared. We were ready. We knew the bombs were going to fall. Everybody in Earth House knew it."
"Earth House? What's that?"
"It's where we came from," Macklin said, crouching on the ground, "up in the Idaho Mountains. We walked a long way and we saw a lot of death, and Roland figured that if we could get to the Great Salt Lake, we could wash ourselves in it, clean all the radiation off, and the salt would heal us."
"Yeah, that's right, you know.
Salt heals, especially this."
He held up his bandage stump. The blood-caked bandages were hanging down, and some of them had turned green. Sheila caught the reek of infected flesh.
"I need to bathe it in that salt water, but they won't let us any closer. They say that we live off the dead, so they shoot at us when we try to cross open ground. But now, we've got our own firepower."
He nodded toward the automatic Roland held.
"It's a big lake," Sheila said. "You don't have to go through that encampment to get there. You could go around it."
"No. Two reasons. Somebody would move into our pit while we were gone and take everything we have. And second, nobody keeps Jimbo Macklin from what he wants."
He grinned at her, and she thought his face resembled a skull.
"They don't know who I am or what I am, but I'm going to show them, oh yes. I'm going to show all of them."
He turned his head toward the encampment, sat staring at the distant torches for a moment, then looked back at her.
"You wouldn't want to fuck, would you?"
She laughed. He was about the dirtiest, most repulsive thing she'd ever seen. But even as she laughed, she knew it was a mistake. She stopped her laugh in mid-note.
"Roland," Macklin said quietly, "bring me the gun."
Roland hesitated. He knew what was about to happen. Still, the king had delivered a command, and he was a king's knight and could not disobey. He took a step forward, hesitated again.
"Roland,"
the king said. This time Roland walked to him and delivered the pistol to his outstretched left hand. Macklin awkwardly gripped it and pointed it at Sheila's head. Sheila lifted her chin defiantly, hooked the pack strap over her shoulder, and stood up.
"I'm going to start walking toward the camp," she said. "Maybe you can shoot a woman in the back, war hero. I don't think you can."
"So long, guys. It's been fun."
She made herself step over Rudy's corpse, then started walking purposefully through the junkyard, her heart pounding and her teeth gritted as she waited for the bullet. Something moved off to her left. A figure in rags ducked down behind the wreckage of a Chevy station wagon. Something else scrambled across the dirt about 20 feet in front of her, and she realized she'd never make the camp alive.
"They're waiting for you," Roland called. "They'll never let you get there."
Sheila stopped. The torches seemed so far away, so terribly far. And even if she reached them without being raped or worse, there was no certainty she wouldn't be raped in the camp. She knew that without Rudy, she was walking meat, drawing flies.
"Better come back," Roland urged. "You'll be safer with us."
Safer, Sheila thought sarcastically. Sure. The last time she'd been safe was when she was in kindergarten. She'd run away from home at 17 with a drummer in a rock band, had landed in Hollywood, and gone through phases of being a waitress, a topless dancer, a masseuse in a Sunset Strip parlor, had done a couple of porno flicks, and then had latched up with Rudy. The world had become a crazy pinwheel of coke, poppers, and faceless Johns, but the deep truth was that she enjoyed it. For her, there was no whining of might-have-beens, no crawling on her knees for forgiveness. She liked danger, liked the dark side of the rock where the night things hid. Safety was boredom, and she'd always figured she could only live once, so why not blow it out? Still, she didn't think running the gauntlet of those crawling shapes would be too much fun. Someone giggled off in the darkness. It was a giggle of insane anticipation, and the sound of it put the lid on Sheila's decision. She turned around and walked back to where the kid and the one-handed war hero waited, and she was already figuring out how to get that pistol and blow both their heads off. The pistol would help her get to the torches at the edge of the lake.
"Get on your hands and knees," Macklin commanded, his eyes glittering above his dirty beard.
Sheila smiled faintly and shrugged her pack off to the ground. What the hell? It would be no worse than some of the other Johns off the strip, but she didn't want to let him win so easily.
"Be a sport, war hero," she said, her hands on her hips. "Why don't you let the kid go first?"
Macklin glanced at the boy, whose eyes behind the goggles looked like they were about to burst from his head. Sheila unbuckled her belt and started to peel the leopard-spotted pants off her hips, then her thighs, then over the cowboy boots. She wore no underwear. She got down on her hands and knees, opened the pack, and took out a bottle of Black Beauties. She popped a pill down her throat and said, "Come on, honey, it's cold out there." Macklin suddenly laughed. He thought the woman had courage. And though he didn't know what was to be done with her after they'd finished, he knew she was of his own kind.
"Go ahead," he told Roland. "Be a man."
Roland was scared shitless. The woman was waiting, and the king wanted him to do it. He figured this was an important rite of manhood for a king's knight to pass through. His testicles were about to explode, and the dark mystery between the woman's thighs drew him toward her like a hypnotic amulet. Dirtwarts crawled closer to get a view of the festivities. Macklin sat watching, his eyes hooded and intense, and he stroked the automatic's barrel back and forth beneath his chin. He heard hollow laughter just over his left shoulder, and he knew the Shadow Soldier was enjoying this too. The Shadow Soldier had come down from Blue Dome Mountain with them, had walked behind them and off to the side, but always there. The Shadow Soldier liked the boy. The Shadow Soldier thought the boy had a killer instinct that bore developing. Because the Shadow Soldier had told Macklin in the silence of the dark that his days of making war were not over yet. This new land was going to need warriors and warlords. Men like Macklin were going to be in demand again. As if they had ever gone out of demand. All this, the Shadow Soldier told him, and Macklin believed. He started laughing then, too, at the sight in front of him. And his laughter and that of the Shadow Soldier intertwined, merged, and became as one.
Chapter 35. Over 2,000 miles away, Sister sat next to the hearth. Everyone else was asleep on the floor around the room, and it was Sister's night to watch over the fire, to keep it banked and the embers glowing so they wouldn't have to waste matches. The space heater had been turned low to save their dwindling supply of kerosene, and cold had begun to sneak through chinks in the walls.
Mona Ramsey muttered in her sleep, and her husband shifted his position and put his arm around her. The old man was dead to the world. Artie lay on a bed of newspapers, and every so often Steve Buchanan snored like a chainsaw. But Sister was disturbed by the wheeze of Artie's breathing. She'd noticed him holding his ribs, but he'd said he was okay, that he was sometimes short of breath, but otherwise feeling, as he put it, as smooth as pickles and cream. She hoped so, because if Artie was hurt somewhere inside, maybe when that damned wolf had slammed into him on the highway about 10 days ago, there was no medicine to stave off infection. The duffel bag was beside her. She loosened the drawstring and reached inside, found the glass ring and drew it out into the ember glow. Its brilliance filled her room. The last time she'd peered into the glass circle, during her fire watch duty 4 nights before, she'd gone dreamwalking again. One second she was sitting right there, holding the circle just as she was doing now, and the next she'd found herself standing over a table, a square table, with what appeared to be cards arranged on its surface. The cards were decorated with pictures, and they were unlike any card Sister had ever seen before. One of them in particular caught her attention, the figure of a skeleton on a rearing skeletal horse, swinging a scythe through what seemed to be a grotesque field of human bodies. She thought there were shadows in the room, other presences, the muffled voices of people speaking. And she thought as well that she heard someone coughing, but the sound was distorted, as if heard through a long echoing tunnel. And when she came back to the cabin, she realized it was Artie coughing and holding his ribs. She'd thought often of that card with the scythe-swinging skeleton. She could still see it lodged behind her eyes. She thought also of the shadows that had seemed to be in the room with her. Insubstantial things, but maybe that was because all her attention had been focused on the cards. Maybe if she'd concentrated on giving form to the shadows, she might have seen who was standing there. Right, she thought. You're acting like you really go somewhere when you see pictures in the glass circle. And that's only what they were, of course. Pictures, fantasy, imagination, whatever. There was nothing real about them at all. But she did know that dreamwalking, and coming back from dreamwalking, was getting easier. Not every time she peered into the glass was a dreamwalk, though. Most often it was just an object of fiery light, no dream pictures at all. Still, the glass ring held an unknown power. Of that, she was certain. If it wasn't something with a powerful purpose, why had the Doyle Halland thing wanted it? Whatever it was, she had to protect it. She was responsible for its safety, and she could not, she dared not, lose it. Jesus in suspenders. What's that? Startled, Sister looked up. Paul Thorson, his eyes swollen from sleep, had come through the green curtain. He pushed back his unruly hair and stood, open-mouthed, as the ring pulsed in rhythm with Sister's heartbeat. She almost shoved it back into the duffel bag, but it was too late. "That thing's on fire," he managed to say. "What is it?"
"I'm not sure yet. I found it in Manhattan."
"My God! The colors!" He knelt down beside her, obviously overwhelmed. A flaming circle of light was about the last thing he'd expected to find when he'd stumbled in to warm himself by the embers. "What makes it pulse like that?"
"It's picking up my heartbeat. It does that when you hold it."
"What is it? Some kind of Japanese thing? Does it run on batteries?"
Sister smiled wryly. "I don't think so."
Paul reached out and poked it with a finger. He blinked. "It's glass."
"That's right."
"Wow," he whispered. Then, "Would it be okay if I held it just for a second?"
She was about to answer yes, but Doyle Halland's promise stopped her.
That monster could make itself look like anyone. Any of the people in this room could be the Doyle Halland thing, even Paul himself. But no, they'd left the monster behind them, hadn't they? How did such a creature travel?
I followed the line of least resistance, she recalled him saying. If he wore human skin, then he traveled as a human, too.
She shuddered, imagining him walking after them in a pair of dead man's shoes, walking day and night without a rest until the shoes flayed right off his feet, and then he stopped to yank another pair off a corpse because he could make any size fit.
Can I? Paul urged.
Where was Doyle Halland, sister wondered. Out there in the dark right now, passing by on I-80. Up ahead a mile or two, running down another pair of shoes. Could he fly in the wind with black cats on his shoulders and his eyes filled with flame, or was he a tattered highway hiker who looked for campfires burning in the night?
He was behind them, wasn't he?
Sister took a deep breath and offered the glass ring to Paul. He slid his hand around it. The light remained constant. The half that Paul held took on a new, quickened rhythm. He drew it to himself with both hands, and Sister let her breath out.
"Tell me about this," he said. "I want to know."
Sister saw the gems reflected in his eyes. On his face was a childlike amazement, as if the years were peeling rapidly away. In another few seconds, he appeared a decade younger than his 43 years. She decided then to tell him all of it. He was quiet for a long time when she'd finished. The ring's pulsing had speeded up and slowed down all through the telling.
"Tarot cards," Paul said, still admiring the ring. "The skeleton with the scythe stands for death."
With an effort, he looked up at her.
"You know, all that sounds crazy as hell, don't you?"
"Yes, I do." "Here's the scar where the crucifix was torn off. Artie saw the thing's face change, too, though I doubt he'll admit it to you. He hasn't mentioned it since it happened, and I guess that's for the best. And here's the glass circle, missing one spike."
"Uh-huh. You haven't been slipping into my Johnny Walker, have you?"
"You know better. I know I see things when I look into the glass. Not every time, but enough to tell me I've either got a hummer of an imagination or..."
"Or what?"
"Or," Sister continued, "there's a reason for me to have it. Why should I see a Cookie Monster doll lying in the middle of a desert, or a hand coming out of a hole? Why should I see a table with tarot cards on it? Hell, I don't even know what the damn things are."
"They're used to tell the future by gypsies, or witches." He summoned a half-smile that made him almost handsome. It faded when she didn't return it. "Listen, I don't know anything about demons with roaming eyeballs or dream-walking, but I do know this is one hell of a piece of glass. A couple of months ago, this thing would have been worth..."
He shook his head.
"Wow," he said again. "The only reason you've got it is that you were in the right place at the right time. That's magic enough, isn't it?"
"But you don't believe what I've told you, right?"
"I want to say the radiations unscrewed your bolts. Or maybe the nukes blew the lid right off hell itself, and who can say what slithered out?"
He returned the ring to her, and she put it back in the bag.
"You take care of that. It may be the only beautiful thing left."
Across the room, Artie winced and sucked in his breath when he changed position, then lay still again.
"He's hurt inside," Paul told her. "I've seen blood in his crap bucket. I figure he's got a splintered rib or two, probably cutting something."
He worked his fingers, feeling the warmth of the glass circle in them.
"I don't think he looks too good."
"I know. I'm afraid whatever's wrong may be infected."
"It's possible." "Shit. With these living conditions, you could die from biting your fingernails."
"And there's no medicine?"
"Sorry. I popped the last Tylenol about 3 days before the bombs hit. A poem I was writing fell to pieces."
"So what are we going to do when the kerosene runs out?"
Paul grunted. He'd been expecting that question, and he'd known no one would ask it but her.
We've got another week's supply, maybe. I'm more worried about the batteries for the radio. When they're dead, these folks are gonna freak. I guess then we'll get out the scotch and have a party.
His eyes were old again.
Just play spin the bottle, and whoever gets lucky can check out first.
Check out? What's that supposed to mean?
I've got a .357 Magnum in that footlocker, lady, he reminded her, and a box of bullets. I've come close to using it on myself twice, once when my second wife left me for a kid half my age, took all my money and said my cock wasn't worth 2 cents in a depression, and the other time, when the poems I'd been working on for 6 years burned up along with the rest of my apartment. That was just after I got kicked off the staff at Millersville State College for sleeping with a student who wanted an A on her English Lit final.
He continued working his knuckles, avoiding Sister's stare.
I'm not what you'd call a real good luck type of guy. As a matter of fact, just about everything I've ever tried to do turned into a shit cake. So that Magnum's been waiting for me for a long time. I'm overdue.
Sister was shocked by Paul's matter-of-factness. He talked about suicide like the next step in a natural progression.
My friend, she said firmly, if you think I've come all this way to blow my brains out in a shack, you're as crazy as I used to.
She bit her tongue. Now he was watching her with heightened interest.
So what are you going to do then? Where are you going to go? Down to the supermarket for a few steaks and a six-pack? How about a hospital to keep Artie from bleeding to death inside, in case you haven't noticed? There's not much left out there.
Well, I never would have taken you for a coward. I thought you had guts, but it must have been just sawdust stuffing.
Couldn't have said it better myself.
What if they want to live?
Sister motioned toward the sleeping figures.
They look up to you. They'll do what you tell them. So you're going to tell them to check out?
They can decide for themselves, but like I say, where are they going to go?
Out there, she said, and she nodded at the door. Into the world, what's left of it at least. You don't know what's 5 or 10 miles down the highway. There might be a civil defense shelter or a whole community of people. The only way to find out is to get in your pickup truck and drive west on I-80.
I didn't like the world as it used to be. I sure as hell don't like it now.
Who asked you to like it? Listen, don't jive me. You need people more than you want to believe.
Sure, he said sarcastically. Love 'em.
Everyone, if you don't need people, Sister challenged, why'd you go up to the highway? Not to kill wolves. You can do that from the front door. You went up to the highway looking for people, didn't you?
Maybe. I wanted a captive audience for my poetry readings.
Uh-huh. Well, when the kerosene's gone, I'm heading west. Artie's going with me.
The wolves'll like that, lady. They'll be happy to escort you.
I'm also taking your rifle, she said, and the rifle bullets.
Thanks for asking my permission.
She shrugged.
All you need is the Magnum. I doubt if you'll have to worry much about the wolves after you're dead. I'd like to take the pickup truck, too.
Paul laughed without mirth.
In case you've forgotten, I told you. It doesn't have much gas, and the brakes are screwed up. The radiator's probably frozen solid by now, and I doubt if there's a gasp in the battery.
Sister had never met anybody so full of reasons to sit on his ass and rot.
Have you tried the truck lately, even if the radiator's frozen? We can light a fire under the damn thing.
You've got it all figured out, huh? Gonna make it to the highway in a broken-down old truck, and right around the bend will be a shining city full of civil defense people, doctors and policemen doing their best to put this fine country back together again. Bet you'll find all the king's horses and all the king's men there, too. Lady, I know what's around the bend. More fucking highway, that's what.
He was working his knuckles harder, a bitter smile flickering at the edges of his mouth.
I wish you luck, lady. I really do. I don't want to wish you luck, she told him. I want you to come with me.
He was silent. His knuckles cracked.
If there's anything left out there, he said, it's going to be worse than Dodge City, Dante's Inferno, the Dark Ages, and No Man's Land all rolled up in one. You're going to see things that'll make your demon with the roaming eyeballs look like one of the seven dwarves.
You like to play poker, but you're not much of a gambler, are you?
Not when the odds have teeth.
I'm going west, Sisters said, giving it one last shot. I'm taking your truck, and I'm going to find some help for Artie. Anybody who wants to can go with me. How about it?
Paul stood up. He looked at the sleeping figures on the floor.
They trust me, he thought. They'll do what I say. But we're warm here, and we're safe, and the kerosene would last only a week longer.
I'll sleep on it,
he said huskily, and he went through the curtain to his own quarters. Sister sat listening to the shriek of the wind. Artie made another gasp of pain in his sleep, his fingers pressed to his side. From off in the distance came the thin, high howling of a wolf, the sound quavering like a violin note. Sister touched the glass circle through the duffel bag's canvas and turned her thoughts toward tomorrow. Behind the green curtain, Paul Thorson opened the footlocker and picked up the .357 Magnum. It was a heavy gun, blue-black with a rough, dark brown grip. The gun felt as if it had been made for his hand. He turned the barrel toward his face and peered into its black, dispassionate eye.
One squeeze, he thought, and it would all be over. So simple, really. The end of a fucked-up journey and the beginning of... what?
He drew a deep breath, released it, and put the gun down. His hand came up with a bottle of scotch, and he took it to bed with him. Chapter 36 Josh dug the grave with a shovel from Leona Skelton's basement, and they buried Davy in the backyard. While Leona bowed her head and said a prayer that the wind took and tore apart, Swan looked up and saw the little terrier sitting about 20 yards away, its head cocked to one side and its ears standing straight up. For the last week, she'd been leaving scraps of food for it on the porch steps. The dog had taken the food, but he never got close enough for Swan to touch. She thought that the terrier was resigned to living off scraps, but it wasn't enough of a beggar yet to fawn and wag its tail for handouts. Josh had finally taken his bath. He could have sewn a suit from the dead skin that peeled away, and the water looked like he'd dumped a shovel full of dirt into it. He'd washed the crusted blood and dirt away from the nub where his right ear had been. The blood had gotten down deep into the canal, and it took him a while to swab it all out. Afterward, he realized he'd only been hearing through one ear. Sounds were startlingly sharp and clear again. His eyebrows were still gone, and his face, chest, arms, hands, and back were striped and splotched with the loss of black pigment, as if he'd been caught by a bucketful of beige paint. He consoled himself with the idea that he resembled a Zulu warrior chieftain in battle regalia or something. His beard was growing out, and it too was streaked with white. Blisters and sores were healing on his face, but on his forehead were seven small black nodules that looked like warts. Two of them had connected with each other. Josh tried to scrape them off with his finger, but they were too tough, and the pain made his entire skull ache. Skin cancer, he thought. But the warts were just on his forehead, nowhere else. I'm a zebra toad frog, he thought. But those nodules, for some reason, disturbed him more than any of his other injuries and scars. He had to put his own clothes back on because nothing in the house would fit him. Leona washed them and went over the holes with a needle and thread, but they were in pretty sorry shape. She did supply him with a new pair of socks, but even those were much too tight. Still, his own socks were bags of holes held together with dried blood, totally useless. After the body was buried, Josh and Swan left Leona alone beside her husband's grave. She gathered a threadbare brown corduroy coat around her shoulders and turned her face from the wind. Josh went to the basement and began to prepare for the journey they'd agreed on. He brought a wheelbarrow upstairs and filled it with supplies, canned food, some dried fruit, petrified corn muffins, 6 tightly sealed mason jars full of well water, blankets and various kitchen utensils, and covered the whole thing with a sheet, which he lashed down with heavy twine. Leona, her eyes puffy from crying but her spine rigid and strong, finally came in and started packing a suitcase. The first items to go in were the framed photographs of her family that had adorned the mantle, and those were followed by sweaters, socks, and the like. She packed a smaller bag full of Joe's old clothes for Swan, and as the wind whipped around the house, Leona walked from room to room and sat for a while in each one, as if drawing from them the aromas and memories of the life that had inhabited them. They were going to head for Matheson at first light. Leona had said she'd take them there, and on their way they'd pass across a farm that belonged to a man named Homer Jaspin and his wife Maggie. The Jaspin farm, Leona told Josh, lay about midway between Sullivan and Matheson, and there they'd be able to spend the night. Leona packed away several of her best crystal balls, and from a box on a closet shelf, she took out a few yellowed envelopes and birthday cards. Courting letters from Davy, she told Swan, and cards Joe had sent her. 2 jars of salve for her rheumatic knees went into her suitcase, and though Leona had never said so, Josh knew that walking that distance, at least 10 miles to the Jaspin farm, was going to be sheer torture for her. But there were no available vehicles, and they had no choice. The deck of tarot cards went into Leona's suitcase as well, and then she picked up another object and took it out to the front room. "Here," she told Swan, "I want you to carry this." Swan accepted the dowsing rod that Leona offered her. "We can't leave Crybaby here all alone, can we?" Leona asked. "Oh, my, no. Crybaby's work isn't done yet, not by a far sight." The night passed, and Josh and Swan slept soundly in beds they were going to regret leaving. He awakened with gloomy gray light staining the window. The wind's force had died down, but the window glass was bitterly cold to the touch. He went into Joe's room and woke Swan up, and then he walked out into the front room and found Leona sitting before the cold hearth, dressed in overalls, clodhoppers, a couple of sweaters, the corduroy coat and gloves. Bags sat on either side of her chair. Josh had slept in his clothes, and now he shrugged into a long overcoat that had belonged to Davy. During the night, Leona had ripped and re-sewn the shoulders and arms so he could get it on, but he still felt like an overstuffed sausage. "I guess we're ready to go," Josh said when Swan emerged, carrying the dowsing rod and clad in a pair of Joe's blue jeans, a thick, dark blue sweater, a fleece-lined jacket, and red mittens. "Just a minute more." Leona's hands were clamped together in her lap. The wind-up clock on the mantel was no longer ticking. "Oh, Lordy," she said, "this is the best house I've ever lived in."
"We'll find you another house," Josh promised. A wisp of a smile surfaced.
"Not like this one. This one's got my life in its bricks. Oh, Lordy, oh, Lordy."
Her head sank down into her hands. Her shoulders shook, but she made no sound. Josh went to a window, and Swan started to put her hand on Leona's arm, but at the last second, she didn't. The woman was hurting, Swan knew. But Leona was preparing herself, too, getting ready for what was to come. After a few minutes, Leona rose from her chair and went to the rear of the house. She returned with her pistol and a box of bullets, and she tucked both of those under the sheet that covered the wheelbarrow.
"We might need those," she said. "Never can tell."
She looked at Swan, then lifted her eyes to Josh.
"I think I'm ready now."
She picked up the suitcase, and Swan took the smaller bag. Josh lifted the wheelbarrow's handles. They weren't so heavy now, but the day was fresh. Suddenly, Leona's suitcase thumped to the floor again.
"Wait," she said, and she hurried into the kitchen.
She came back with a broom, which she used to sweep ashes and dead embers from the floor into the hearth.
"All right,"
she put the broom aside.
"I'm ready now."
They left the house and started in a northwesterly direction through the remains of Sullivan. The little gray-haired terrier followed them at a distance of about 30 yards, his stubby tail straight up to balance against the wind. Chapter 37. Darkness found them short of the Jaspin farm. Josh tied the bullseye lantern to the front of the wheelbarrow with twine. Leona had to stop every half hour or so, and while she laid her head in Swan's lap, Josh gently massaged her legs. The tears Leona was weeping from the pain in her rheumatic knees crisscrossed the dust that covered her cheeks. Still, she made no sound, no complaint. After she'd rested for a few minutes, she would struggle up again, and they'd continue on across rolling grassland, burned black and oily by radiation. The lantern's beam fell upon a rail fence about 4 feet tall and half blown down by the wind.
"I think we're near the house," Leona offered.
Josh manhandled the wheelbarrow over the fence, then lifted Swan over and helped Leona across. Facing them was a black cornfield, the diseased stalks standing as high as Josh and whipping back and forth like strange seaweed at the bottom of a slimy pool. It took them about 10 minutes to reach the far edge of the field, and the lantern's beam hit the side of a farmhouse that had once been painted white, now splotched brown and yellow like lizard skin.
"That's Homer and Maggie's place," Leona shouted against the wind.
The house was dark, not a candle or lantern showing. There was no sign of a car or truck anywhere around either. But something was making a loud, irregular banging noise off to the right, beyond the light's range. Josh untied the lantern and walked toward the sound. About 50 feet behind the house was a sturdy-looking red barn, one of its doors open and the wind banging it against the wall. Josh returned to the house and aimed the light at the front door. It was wide open, the screen door unlatched and thumping back and forth in the wind as well. He told Swan and Leona to wait where they were, and he entered the dark Jaspin farmhouse. Once inside, he started to ask if anyone was home, but there was no need. He smelled the rank odor of decomposing flesh and almost gagged on it. He had to wait for a moment, bent over a decorative brass spittoon with a dead bunch of daisies in it, before he was sure he wouldn't throw up. Then he began to move through the house, sweeping the light slowly back and forth, looking for the bodies. Outside, Swan heard a dog barking furiously in the black cornfield they'd just come through. She knew that the terrier had shadowed them all day, never coming closer than 20 feet, darting away when Swan bent down to summon it nearer. The dog's found something out there, Swan thought, or something's found it. The barking was urgent, a come-see-what-I've-got kind of bark. Swan set her bag down and leaned Crybaby against the wheelbarrow. She took a couple of steps toward the black swaying cornfield. Leona said,
"Child, Josh said to stay right here." "It's all right," she answered,
and she took 3 more steps.
"Swan!"
Leona warned when she realized where the little girl was heading. She started to go after her, but immobilizing pain shot through her knees.
"You'd best not go in there."
The terrier's barking summoned Swan. and she stepped into the cornfield. The black stalks closed at her back. Leona shouted, "Swan!" In the farmhouse, Josh followed the beam of light into a small dining area. The cupboard had been flung open, and the floor was littered with chips and pieces of shattered crockery. Chairs had been smashed against the wall, a dining table hacked apart. The smell of decay was stronger. The light picked out something scrawled on the wall. "All shall praise Lord Alvin." Written in brown paint, Josh thought. But no, no. The blood had run down the wall and gathered in a crusty little patch on the floor. A doorway beckoned him. He took a deep breath, straining the horrid smell through his clenched teeth, and walked through the doorway. He was in a kitchen with yellow-painted cupboards and a dark rug, and there he found them, what was left of them. They had been tied to chairs with barbed wire. The woman's face, framed with blood-streaked gray hair, resembled a bloated pincushion punctured by an assortment of knives, forks, and the little two-pronged handles that stick into the ends of corn on the cob. On the man's bare chest, someone had drawn a target in blood and gone to work with a small-caliber pistol or rifle. The head was missing. "Oh, my God," Josh croaked. And this time he couldn't hold back the sickness. He stumbled across the kitchen to the sink and leaned over it. But the lantern's light, swinging in his hand, showed him that the sink's basin was already occupied. As Josh shouted in terror and revulsion, the hundreds of roaches that covered Homer Jaspin's severed head broke apart and scurried madly over the sink and countertop. Josh staggered backward, the bile burning in his throat, and his feet slipped out from under him. He fell to the floor where the dark rug lay and felt crawling things on his arms and legs. The floor, he realized. The floor? The floor around the bodies was an inch deep in surging, scrambling roaches. As the roaches swarmed over his body, Josh had a sudden ridiculous thought. You can't kill those things. Not even a nuclear disaster can kill them. He leaped up from the floor, sliding on roaches, and started running from that awful kitchen, swatting at the things as he ran, swiping them off his clothes and skin. He fell to the carpet in the front room and rolled wildly on it. Then he got up again and barreled for the screen door. Leona heard the noise of splintering wood and ripping screen, and she turned toward the house in time to see Josh bring the whole door with him like a charging bull. There goes another screen door, she thought. And then she saw Josh fling himself to the ground and start rolling, swatting, and squirming as if he'd run into a nest of hornets. What is it? She called, hobbling toward him. What the hell's wrong with you? Josh got up on his knees. He was still holding the lantern, while the other hand flopped and flipped here and there all over his body. Leona stopped in her tracks because she'd never seen such terror in human eyes in her life. What is it?
Don't go in there. Don't you go in there, he babbled, squirming and shaking.
A roach ran over his cheek and he grabbed it and flung it away with a shiver.
You stay out of that damned house.
I will,
she promised, and she peered at the dark square where the door had been. A bad odor reached her. She'd smelled that reek before, back in Sullivan, and she knew what it was. Josh heard a dog barking.
Where's Swan?
He stood up, still dancing and jerking.
Where'd she go?
In there,
Leona pointed toward the black cornfield.
I told her not to.
Damn,
Josh said, because he'd realized that whoever had done such a job on Homer and Maggie Jaspin might still be in the area. Maybe he was even in that barn, watching and waiting. Maybe he was out in that field with the child. He dug the pistol and the box of bullets out of the wheelbarrow and hurriedly slid three shells into their cylinders.
You stay right here, he told Leona, and don't you go in that house.
Then, lantern in one hand and pistol in the other, he sprinted into the cornfield. Swan was following the terrier's barking. The sound ebbed and swelled with the wind, and around her the long-dead corn stalks rustled and swayed, grabbing at her clothes with leathery tendrils. She felt as if she were walking through a cemetery where all the corpses were standing upright, but the dog's frantic summons pulled her onward. There was something important in the field, something the dog wanted known, and she was determined to find out what it was. She thought the barking was off to the left, and she began to move in that direction. Behind her, she heard Josh shout, "Swan!" And she replied, "Over here!" But the wind turned. She kept going, her hands up to shield her face from the whipping stalks. The barking was closer. No, Swan thought, now it was moving to the right again. She continued on, thought she heard Josh calling her again. "I'm here," she shouted, but she heard no reply. The barking moved again, and Swan knew the terrier was following something or someone. The barking said, "Hurry, hurry, come see what I've found." Swan had taken 6 more steps when she heard something crashing toward her through the field. The terrier's voice got louder, more urgent. Swan stood still, watching and listening. Her heart had begun to pound, and she knew that whatever was out there was coming in her direction and getting closer. "Who's there?" she shouted. The crashing noise was coming right at her. "Who's there?" The wind flung her voice away. She saw something coming toward her through the corn, something not human, something huge. She couldn't make out its shape or what it was, but she heard a rumbling noise and backed away, her heart about to hammer through her chest. The huge, misshapen thing was coming right at her, faster and faster now, cleaving right through the dead swaying stalks, and in another few seconds it would be upon her. She wanted to run, but her feet had rooted to the ground, and there was no time because the thing was crashing at her, and the terrier was barking an urgent warning. The monster tore through the corn stalks and towered over her, and Swan cried out, got her feet uprooted, and stumbled back, was falling, hit the ground on her rear, and sat there while the monster's legs pounded toward her. "Swan!" Josh shouted, bursting through the stalks behind her and aiming his light at what was about to trample her. Dazzled by the light's beam, the monster stopped in its tracks and reared up on its hind legs, blowing steam through its widened nostrils. And both Swan and Josh saw what it was. A horse. A piebald, black-and-white blotched horse with frightened eyes and oversized shaggy hooves. The terrier was yapping tenaciously at its heels, and the piebald horse whinnied with fear, dancing on its hind legs for a few seconds before it came down again, inches from where Swan sat in the dirt. Josh hooked Swan's arm and yanked her out of harm's way as the horse pranced and spun, the terrier darting around its legs with undaunted courage. Swan was still shaking, but she knew in an instant that the horse was more terrified. It turned this way and that, confused and dazed, looking for a way of escape. The dog's barking was scaring it further, and suddenly Swan pulled free from Josh and took 2 steps forward, almost under the horse's nose. She lifted her hands and clapped her palms together right in front of the horse's muzzle. The horse flinched, but ceased jittering around. Its fear-filled eyes were fixed on the little girl. Steam curling from its nostrils, its lungs rumbling. Its legs trembled as if they might give way or take flight. The terrier kept yapping, and Swan pointed a finger at it. "Hush," she said. The dog scrambled away a few feet, but caught back the next bark. Then, as if deciding it had come too close to the humans and compromised its independence, darted away into the cornfield. It stood its distance and continued to bark, intermittently. Swan's attention was aimed at the horse, and she kept its eyes locked with her own. Its large, less-than-lovely head trembled, wanting to pull away from her, but it either would not or could not.
"Is it a boy or a girl?"
Swan asked Josh. "Huh?" He still thought he felt roaches running up and down his backbone, but he shifted the lantern's beam. "A boy,"
he said. And a whopper of a boy, he thought.
He hasn't seen people for a long time, I bet. Look at him. He doesn't know whether to be glad to see us or run away.
He must have belonged to the Jaspins, Josh said.
Did you find them in the house?
She kept watching the horse's eyes. Yes, I mean, no, I didn't. I found signs of them. They must have packed up and gone. There was no way he was letting Swan into that house.
The horse rumbled nervously, its legs moving from side to side for a few steps.
Swan slowly lifted her hand toward the horse's muzzle. Be careful, Josh warned. He'll snap your fingers right off.
Swan continued to reach upward, slowly and surely. The horse backed away, its nostrils wide and its ears flicking back and forth. It lowered its head, sniffing the ground, then pretended to be looking off in another direction. But Swan saw the animal appraising her, trying to make up his mind about them.
We're not going to hurt you,
Swan said quietly, her voice soothing. She stepped toward the horse, and he snorted a nervous warning.
Watch out. He might charge you or something. Josh knew absolutely nothing about horses, and they'd always scared him. This one was big and ugly and ungainly, with shaggy hooves and a floppy tail and a suede back that looked like he'd been saddled with an anvil.
He's not too sure about us, Swan told Josh. He's still making up his mind whether to run or not. But I think he's kind of glad to see people again.
What are you, an expert on horses?
No. I can just tell from the set of his ears and the way his tail is swishing back and forth. Look at how he's smelling us. He doesn't want to seem too friendly. Horses have got a lot of pride. I think this one likes people, and he's been lonely.
Josh shrugged. I sure can't tell any of that.
My mama and I lived in a motel one time next to a pasture where somebody's horses grazed. I used to climb over the fence and walk around with them. And I guess I learned how to talk to them, too.
Talk to them? Come on.
Well, not human talk, she amended. A horse talks with his ears and tail, and how he holds his head in his body. He's talking right now, she said as the horse snorted and gave a nervous whinny.
What's he saying?
He's saying that he wants to know what we're talking about.
Swan continued to lift her hand toward the animal's muzzle.
Watch your fingers.
The horse retreated a pace. Swan's hand continued to rise, slowly, slowly.
No one's going to hurt you, Swan said, in a voice that sounded to Josh like the music of a lute,
or a lyre, or some instrument that people had forgotten how to play. Its soothing quality almost made him forget the horrors tied to chairs back in the Jaspin farmhouse.
Come on, Swan urged. We won't hurt you.
Her fingers were inches away from the muzzle, and Josh started to reach out and pull her back before she lost them to crunching teeth. The horse's ears twitched and slanted forward. He snorted again, pawed at the ground, and lowered his head to accept Swan's touch.
That's right, Swan said. That's right, boy.
She scratched his muzzle, and he pushed inquisitively at her arm with his nose. Josh wouldn't have believed it if he hadn't seen it. Still, Swan was probably right. The horse simply missed people.
I think you've made a friend. Doesn't look like much of a horse, though. Looks like a sway-back mule in a clown suit.
I think he's kind of pretty.
Swan rubbed between the horse's eyes, and the animal obediently lowered his head so she wouldn't have to stretch up so far. The horse's eyes were still frightened, and Swan knew if she made a sudden move, he'd bolt into the cornfield and probably not return. So she kept all her movements slow and precise. She thought that the horse was likely old because there was a weary patience in the droop of his head and flanks, as if he was resigned to a life of pulling a plow across the very field in which they stood. His dappled skin jittered and jumped, but he allowed Swan to rub his head and made a low noise in his throat that sounded like a sigh of relief.
"I left Leona over by the house," Josh said. "We'd better get back."
Swan nodded and turned away from the horse, following Josh through the field. She'd taken about a half dozen steps when she sensed